This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, Managing Editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are here and ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And via Skype connection in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
And from Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Are America and Iran about to go to war? The prospect of another war in the Middle East appears to be heating up. To learn the latest, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, there's a lot that's been happening over the past 2 weeks now with an increase of U.S. forces in the region. A couple of stories came out this week that shows that the U.S. forces did have a credible threat and still do against them and our allies in the region. And this was largely due to a meeting that took place in Iraq, led by Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, that oversees Iran's actions outside of Iran. He's basically in charge of all the different proxy organizations, directing them in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Palestinian territories, Lebanon. He's in charge of all of it. And he had a meeting, I guess, about 3 weeks ago now. In Iraq, he brought together several of the proxies there that they have control over. These are now parts of actually the Iraqi military, but He brought them together and he told them to get ready for proxy war because it might be heating up here soon with the United States. And in response to that is why we've had over the past 2 weeks now the increase of U.S. Weaponry, B-52s, aircraft carriers, different transport ships into the Persian Gulf. We're still not at the levels of the materiel that was there from 2003 to 2011 when the U.S. forces were engaged in Iraq, and so nobody expects a U.S. invasion of Iran right now. The U.S. doesn't want that. Iran doesn't want that. They don't have the forces to do that. Nevertheless, there are concrete threats against the United States forces because the United States force right now is small in Syria, in Iraq, 5,000 troops in one, couple thousand troops in another, and you have 100,000 troops basically that answer to Soleimani at his disposal in these nations. And so because of that, the U.S. decided that it's going to increase its presence.
So in response to the threat, not only is the United States increasing its presence in the materiel that are going into the region, but it's also said that it wants the non-essential staff out of Iraq.
Right. So you've got a couple of different stations where the State Department has people in Iraq. They're in the capital, the embassy of Baghdad. The U.S. has pulled out all non-essential staff from there. They've also pulled out all non-essential staff from the consulate in Erbil, the Kurdish region in the north. And then they do this because they expect that Iranian proxies are going to fire on these U.S. assets. And they have done in the past. Basra is another place in Iraq that has a consulate that's been shut now for about almost a year because that was attacked by a rocket attack by an Iranian-backed militia back in September last year. So they've pulled out those forces. Also, the German army has decided that it's going to stop its training mission in Iraq right now. They were training the Kurds in the north. They are pulling out because it's getting too dangerous. Also, the Dutch, they had 50 personnel there in the north also in training mission. They're pulling out of Iraq because they expect it to heat up also. And so, yes, while they might not be a United States invasion into Iran, there are plenty of signs that the threat is real, the threat is serious, and that the Iranian proxies are willing to act. Again, this is a way that Iran can deflect blame, not be directly behind an attack if one of these proxy organizations fights for it. And so this is kind of the weapon of choice that they use or have used probably over the past 15 years.
So the United States was increasing the military presence in the region, sending the aircraft carrier and so on, while holding its cards close to its chest in terms of what the specifics were of why that was happening. There was the New York Times report that suggested that they knew. This seems like it's different than that. How confident are we that this really is the reason? This was Soleimani bringing these proxy groups in and telling them we need to brace for war.
Well, I guess there has been it was on Thursday that this meeting was reported, and it is across the board. Of course, it is Western intelligence agencies that are saying this meeting took place with him. They have Soleimani actually saying this, and so we know that this was the direction that they wanted to take, and so this is a legitimate threat against them. And then just this week, I mean, we had a couple of different actual attacks by Iranian proxies against U.S. allies in the region as well, and so they are turning to specific attacks. They haven't attacked American forces yet, but they probably are going to delay that as long as possible, it seems, because that might incur the American a hard American response.
So, Richard, you talked about oil, the threat to global oil supplies on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show yesterday, and it does seem like just the fact that you have the sanctions coming against Iranian oil, that you have America putting the squeeze on Iran and threatening these Iranian oil supplies, this has ramifications that are more broad as well. Maybe you could just summarize what you spoke about on the radio yesterday.
Sure. So you look at some of the things that Iran was doing with oil over the last week, and I think they are, and it's not just me that thinks that. A lot of experts are saying they are deliberately sending a message here. They targeted, or there were boats targeted near the Straits of Hormuz. The United States has said Iran was behind it. Like you just heard from Brent, Iran's been putting their proxy forces on alert. So yeah, Iran was probably behind those. Then you had the Houthi rebels target an oil pipeline that goes from Saudi Arabia out towards the Red Sea. And they targeted that oil pipeline as well. And the Houthis are backed by Iran. So it seems like you're getting a clear message from Iran. We're going after you. We have the power to go after your oil. It doesn't matter whether it's coming out of the Straits of Hormuz, where 20% of all oil produced in the world comes through. That's just mind-blowing. But 20% of all the world's oil, Straits of Hormuz, Iran is saying, we can get that if we want to. We can have our proxies attack that. And then when Saudi Arabia tries to get around that choke point by building an oil pipeline that goes across their country and goes to the Red Sea and then, from then on up into Europe, well, then they're saying, well, through our proxies for the Houthis, we can get that as well. So it's a deliberate deliberate threat, really, to the world's oil. Whether they follow through on that threat now or whether it's later remains to be seen. But they're showing that they can cause real damage to the world's economy. And then the other thing I talked about on the show yesterday, there was just a really interesting interview on Deutsche Welle, just the news anchors talking, and they made the point that, the United States is the one that's making the news here, but Europe is the one that's going to be most effective. Mm. If Iran does start targeting this oil, if Iran does start making the Middle East explode, well, we're the ones that are next door. We're the ones that rely on that oil. The United States is almost self-sufficient in their oil. I think they still need about 2 million barrels a day, but pretty close to self-sufficiency. So Europe is looking at this and saying, well, we might need to do something about this because we're the ones that this directly affects.
Yeah. So, Brent, as you're looking at all of these elements that are in play, looking at it from through the lens of Bible prophecy, how do you view what's happening here?
Yeah, well, it definitely follows on from what Richard is saying. I mean, these two attacks that took place were extremely specific. They're not random attacks against, Saudi Arabia. They attack the pipeline, basically the backup plan that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have to getting oil to Europe. That's what was attacked.
Yeah.
It was attacked because this port that Richard mentioned, that pipeline, but where these four ships were attacked at port, this is also there's also a pipeline that goes to there where the UAE can get its oil down to outside the Strait of Hormuz, so it doesn't have to get through that. So Iran says, if you want to go through the Strait of Hormuz, we can get you with that. We can stop that. If you want to go through the Bab al-Mandab, we can stop that as well, the other oil choke point. Then if you want to pipe it out to the Indian Ocean, we can attack that port. Then if you want to pipe it across to the Red Sea, we can attack that pipeline. And Bible prophecy says that Iran is going to use this strategy on Europe. They are going to stop trade, oil trade, through these critical choke points. And Bible prophecy also says they're actually going to get the big one. They're going to get the Suez Canal. They are going. So it doesn't matter, Saudi Arabia, even if you push it all the way through to the upper parts of the Red Sea, bypassing the Bab al-Mandab, you've still got to go through the Suez Canal to get that oil to Europe. And Bible prophecy says, based on Daniel 11, verse 40 to 43, that Egypt is going to come under the sway of Iran as well. And then when that happens, how does Europe get its oil? Right now, they're thirsty for especially Saudi Arabian oil. Saudi Arabia is planning more refineries up in the Netherlands right now to try and ship more there and refine it in Europe. And so that's their game plan, and Iran is very much set out against to stop that. If people want to read about more about this, they can definitely read our editor-in-chief's book, The King of the South. It describes this strategy, this push that Iran will play at Europe, and how the factor that oil will play in it.
And just to tie up the loose ends, any thoughts on how the tensions between the United States and Iran may play out?
That's the million-dollar question. We'll see. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a temporary negotiation at the table.
Well, Donald Trump actually said he would be willing to meet with top Iranian leaders. That's quite a statement.
he said, I'm ready to go. The door's open. Let's do this. Let's negotiate a better deal for all of us. You have plenty of others inside his government that do not want that to happen. You have plenty of Iranians that do not want that to happen, both the hardliners and also those in Iran that want this regime gone, understanding that's the only way that they can get out of that regime. So I don't know if it'll happen, but I think American presence in the region always has a stabilizing effect temporarily.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, please do keep your eye on all of those developments and keep us informed. We appreciate that very much, Brent. Well, a shakeup in British politics looks inevitable after some unusual events yesterday. To learn what happened, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
It feels like I've been on this show pretty often to tell you the end of British Prime Minister Theresa May is nigh. She is still here. But I'm here to tell you that once again, and it's looking much more certain now that she is on the way out. So she was called before, yesterday she was called before the 1922 committee. This is basically the leadership steering committee of the Conservative Party. You know, they set the rules for the Conservative Party. Now, you may remember her opponents tried to get rid of her back in, I think it was around December. They failed. She won the confidence vote. Under Conservative Party rules, that means she can't be challenged for another year. At this point, though, she's so unpopular, the 1922 committee basically said, look, you need to resign. Otherwise, we have enough support that we could just rewrite the rules and make it so you can be challenged, and we will find a way of kicking you out. So they confronted her with that. One person told The Telegraph, describing the meeting and Miss May's reaction, that she was emotional, a lot more emotional than I've ever seen her before. People talked about her crying or tearing up at this meeting as she kind of begged for more time. Though he did say that she quickly got back to a strong view about what needs to be done. So anyway, she kind of begged for a bit more time, and it looks like they granted her that. So what the plan is going forward is her deal is going to go before Parliament. That has been rejected three times. It's going to go before Parliament a fourth time at the start of June.
Fourth time's a charm.
But then after that, whether it passes or fails, she's going to sit down with the leaders of the 1922 committee and agree a timetable for her to leave. So if her deal is voted down, probably she'll be, people are saying she'll probably announce her resignation pretty soon, beginning of June, kind of be out of there end of June, beginning of July. If her deal passes on the fourth time around, Then they're saying, well, maybe she'll be allowed to stay around a little longer to kind of oversee some of the implementation, but then be gone by autumn.
So Stephen Fleury was talking about this this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and he mentioned a possible successor that might have implications for the U.S.-America relationship as well.
Yes, well, Boris Johnson is very popular with Conservative Party grassroots members. He gets compared to Donald Trump fairly often for no other reason. Well, if for no other reason than just his hairstyle. But I think there are some similarities in their style, in the way that they are, you know, plain talking,
yeah,
have a kind of a mass appeal to people who are fed up of politicians. So he announced yesterday that he was going to be standing for leadership elections whenever they did come up. So he's a major contender. He's less popular among the politicians themselves. So the way the leadership election process works is the Conservative Party pick their top two candidates, or the MPs, sorry, pick their top two candidates, and then the Conservative Party as a whole, with all of those, you know, hundreds of thousands of people up and down the country, pick from those two who they want. So it's a case of Boris Johnson can get in the top two, he'll probably get the job. It's just a case of can he make it to the top two within the MPs.
So we've been following this the mess in British politics and the implementation of the Brexit vote for quite some time. What's your sense of whether this would provide any kind of steadying hand to that process?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. On the one hand, one person at the 1922 committee meeting put it fairly well, where they said, well, changing the weatherman doesn't change the weather, which is true. There's a tough situation out there. Having said that, though, you know, you've got this, like you mentioned, and like Mr. Fleury mentioned on the show, you look at some of the prophecies about Britain and America. You look about some of the prophecies going down together. You look at the way America has had a bit of a resurgence under President Trump. Well, maybe if you do get a British leader who is kind of brings Britain and America closer together, then maybe that could make things better for a time. But ultimately, what the Bible makes clear, especially in the book of Hosea, it talks about how Britain and America are going down together. You know, whether there's a temporary resurgence, both are going down pretty soon, and no individual is going to be able to turn this around. I mean, we've talked about this pretty consistently in our coverage of Brexit, where you just look at the situations that Britain is in today, and you look at scriptures like Isaiah 58 and Isaiah 3 that describe just this. Well, Isaiah 1 talks about the whole head being sick. They describe just this big mess, and nobody knows what to do. Those prophecies are there, you know, because that's the condition that God's prophesied. And having a new leader, even if we see a temporary resurgence, isn't going to fundamentally change that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bible does say that Britain and America are on the way down in the long term. But the Bible also says that it's part of a plan that God has for Britain and for America. So it is definitely not all bad news. To really understand that plan and the good news at the end of it, you can get our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that just goes through all of what the Bible says about what's coming for our two nations.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, we will keep our eyes on that, and we'll start our countdown to Theresa May's departure clock. We've had our Angela Merkel clock going for quite some time. I'm sure that's going to hit zero at one point, but we'll see what happens there in Britain. Thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Another trend the Trumpet closely watches for is the development of a pan-Asian alliance. Two important nations in that alliance are definitely drawing closer together. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, one of China's highest-ranking diplomats, a man named Yang Jixia, is visiting Japan right now, and he's there to try to prepare the way for Chinese President Xi Jinping to visit Japan next month when it hosts the big G20 summit. So Yang Jixia is he's on the Politburo of the Chinese Communist Party's Central Committee. He's He's one of the most powerful men in the government, really. And if he's able to work things out for Chairman Xi to visit, it'll be the first time a Chinese leader has visited Japan since back in 2010. And analysts seem pretty optimistic that this trip could happen because there's been just quite a considerable thaw recently in the relationship between China and Japan, which has been historically just fraught with tensions. And those tensions are due mostly to the invasion of China by Japan before World War II, and just how barbarically the Japanese killed hundreds of thousands of Chinese civilians during that time. And then China and Japan also have some very heated ongoing territorial disputes right now over the Senkaku Islands and parts of the East China Sea as well. So they have plenty of reasons to not really be getting along. But in recent years, they've been taking some pretty serious steps toward reconciliation. This has been especially clear since the 40th anniversary of the China-Japan Peace Treaty, which was just this past August. And then 2 months after that, the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, he traveled to China, and he promised to bring relationships to kind of a new and a warmer, more conciliatory era. And then just last month, China ended up replacing their envoy to Japan, a guy who is not very pro-Japanese, had been the envoy for about a decade, but now they have a really pro-Japanese envoy taking his place. So both sides are really making some pretty significant efforts there toward a reconciliation.
What's motivating it?
Well, it's part of this is just the fact that Japan has long relied on the United States. It's been almost entirely aligned with the U.S. But the U.S. is suddenly not very predictable and also not as keen on being extended all over the world, especially in Asia. The Trump administration has sent quite a lot of mixed messages to its allies like Japan, and even openly encouraged Japan to begin to prepare to fight its own battles and not to rely on the U.S. militarily and things like that. So that's part of it. Trade is also a huge part of it. These are the world's second and third largest economies, and the trade between them is massive. Mm-hmm. It's hard to even comprehend it, but China is Japan's most important trade partner, and it's Japan's largest source of imports. It's also its largest trade destination. And then for China, Japan is its second largest trade partner. And international trade is really the lifeblood of especially the Japanese economy. So, and then there's also partnerships that we see forming between them. For example, China's Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, Japan has recently signed on to that. And then Japan has also given some indications, some pretty significant ones, that it could be on board with China's Belt and Road Initiative. So those are all just big factors showing that a reconciliation is happening, and it's partly due to just pragmatism and economics, and partly because the world is shifting. There's a big shift away from Japan's reliance on the U.S., and that means it needs to start to shore up alliances elsewhere.
To think that the trumpet, Gerald Fleury, that Herbert W. Armstrong, and the Plain Truth for decades before talked about this Pan-Asian alliance. And certainly we know that China is part of that based on biblical prophecy. There's been a lot of talk of what sort of a role Japan may play in that alliance. But considering that those forecasts were made even in the middle of quite tense relations between those two nations, really makes what you're seeing today give you a lot of credence to the view of biblical prophecy in terms of what we can expect in world events.
Yes, I think it really validates and vindicates those forecasts of both Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Fleury, saying despite Japan's historic and even very recent horrible tensions with China, in the 50s and 60s, those World War II memories were very, very fresh. But even during that time, Mr. Armstrong said Japan will lay aside these differences and will join that Kings of the East Asian bloc that Revelation 16, verse 12 talks about. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written a lot about Japan's entrance into that block as well in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to that booklet in the show notes for today's program, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. It makes specific mention of the verses in the Bible that you can look at that show this relationship between China and Japan. So you can go check that out there on thetrumpet.com. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. The state of Alabama just weighed in on the abortion debate in America, and it guaranteed that the legal battles over this question are going to intensify. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Alabama lawmakers have crafted the strictest abortion legislation in the nation, with Alabama Governor Kay Ivory signing that into law on Wednesday. This legislation unequivocally declares an unborn baby as a human being, and it makes it a felony to kill that human being at any point during pregnancy, any point after conception. In almost all cases, the only exception the bill allows for is in cases where the doctor's certain that the life of the mother is at jeopardy, and if he's having to choose between two lives, they would allow the abortion in that case and in that case only. So far stricter than any other piece of any other abortion law in the United States right now, and very clearly a violation of the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court ruling. The Supreme Court ruled in 1973 that a woman's right to privacy supersedes a baby's right to life, and it overturned laws like this one. Any state law that banned abortion was deemed unconstitutional. But this is not an oversight on Alabama's part. Actually, after signing it, the governor of Alabama made the statement that many Americans, including myself, disagreed when Roe versus Wade was handed down in 1973. The sponsors of this bill believe that it is time once again for the Supreme Court to revisit this important matter. They believe this act may bring about the best opportunity for this to occur. So the bill was definitely specially crafted that it's they're betting that it's going to be overturned in an appellate court, and then that appellate court then they'll petition the Supreme Court, and the way the court system works, this could all take a couple of years. Though in this case, if you're also betting that President Trump's going to get elected again, and one of the justices, probably Ruth Bader Ginsburg, either retires or dies before then, and you get another pro-life judge on the court, you've got a 6-3 majority. They're thinking that they've got this this perfectly timed out.
Although some people say that this is maybe too much too soon. Some pro-life voices.
Possibly both Justices John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh are trying to position themselves as like nonpartisan centrist. And so, I mean, I don't know enough about their past rulings to make a prediction on which way they'd rule in a case like this. But, I mean, there are some who are saying that if you try to force their hand, they may just rule in favor of court precedent and uphold Roe versus Wade, thinking that it could have been wiser to, instead of overturning Roe versus Wade, try to gut it by like chipping away at the edges for narrowing down exactly when, not overturning the constitutional right to abortion, but just try to make it so abortion in such specific circumstances.
Yeah.
And then it becomes less meaningful.
I guess exactly how this plays out legally remains a question, but you could see immediately that this is going to deepen the cultural divisions, because this is all happening at the same time that you have states, state legislatures that are deliberately aiming to pass legislation that is more pro-abortion. So it seems like in some ways this is as stark of a representation of the cultural divisions within the United States as anything that we're seeing.
Right. You'll definitely see that both within Alabama and within the nation more broadly. Within Alabama, I've already heard one report of a doctor who said that he will continue to provide abortions despite what the Alabama law says, because he can appeal to the federal precedent, which puts law enforcement in a bit of a bind, kind of similar to, you find similar things with like marijuana laws in the United States, where the federal government's banned it. Certain 20-something of the states have legalized it. And so those laws are, it gets dicey when you're enforcing something that's illegal, I guess in the abortion case, illegal federally and legal on the state level.
Right.
But then also, like you said, it's like Alabama's just passed the strictest abortion law in the nation, making it a felony to kill a child at pretty much any stage of pregnancy. But meanwhile, New York's passing laws that are pretty much almost verging on infanticide or like partial birth, like post, they're even debating like post-birth abortion. And so now you've got this divide between the states that's entering the national debate, to where it's, there's definitely going to be national division over the issue, regardless of whether, even if Roe versus Wade was overturned, that would just throw the issue back to the states. And now you've got certain states that are debating post-birth abortion and certain states that are banning the practice entirely.
Yeah, with considering how many issues there are in the United States that are dividing the electorate and that are creating tremendous, you know, outspoken, angry hatred, division between Americans, you just wonder how much is this going to be inserted into the national debate as we, you know, gear up for another presidential election here over the next year and a half. It could become quite a sticking point.
It could be, yeah. And prophetically, Richard already mentioned the Isaiah 1:5 prophecy about the whole head being sick and the whole heart being faint, and then it goes on a little later about the people revolting more and more. That's kind of describing this type of just division and turmoil that comes into a nation in a general sense. And then also we have article we can put in the show notes by Mr. Fred Dadlow titled "Is Abortion Really Murder?" That makes an airtight scriptural argument for the fact that life does begin at conception, citing many different verses. One in particular in the Old Testament, we're talking about like Old Testament laws on how to punish murderers, and talking about that even if like people are fighting and a pregnant woman gets hurt and the baby dies, the person's basically tried for manslaughter.
Right.
It was, even if it's an accidental birth, but it's like, so you've killed an unborn child, the penalty is the same as if you've killed an adult person. When you just really look at the depth of that, it's like life begins at conception, abortion's murder. You've aborted 60 million babies in the United States since Roe v. Wade. I mean, there's a lot of sins in America, and that's definitely not one of the smaller ones. I mean, that's like when you're looking at the scriptural implication that the life of a unborn child is the same as the life of an adult, and you've murdered 60 million. I mean, just numerically, that's like the Holocaust times 10.
Well, you know, you have to hand it to these lawmakers in Alabama for stepping out and taking such a strong stand against something that really is so abominable. And one argument that I think is very compelling that you hear the pro-life movement making is that at the time of Roe v. Wade in 1973, the knowledge of what was happening in the womb was far less significant, far less detailed than what we have now, with all of the technology that we have to determine just how what exactly is happening day to day in the, over the course of that gestation. We really have no excuse to say, well, you know, this life inside of a woman, it's just a clump of cells, or, you know, whatever argument the pro-abortionists want to make, science is showing that it just doesn't hold up. It doesn't stand up to what is clearly visible and testable and understandable using the scientific tools and methods that we have today. And yet, as you say, the pro-abortion side of it just wants to dismiss all of that evidence, cast it aside completely, and just say, we want to prioritize the right of a woman to make this choice for her own benefit, regardless of who it's killing, regardless of the evidence to the contrary. And that's a bold stand to take. So the fact that you have these lawmakers who are taking a bold stand in defense of the defenseless, I think really is something that is quite extraordinary to see them doing. Well, we'll end the discussion there. We appreciate that. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about evidence of China preparing to take over Taiwan and Iran preparing to attack Israel. We'll also talk about why some people in South Africa may not be able to hear this radio program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
A new U.S. Defense Department report draws a troubling conclusion. China is gearing up to take over Taiwan. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we spoke last week on the show about the Pentagon's new report to Congress, just about the power of China's People's Liberation Army. And we spoke at that time specifically about the rapidly growing submarine fleet that the PLA is building. And there's another aspect of this report that I wanted to bring some attention to this week. And as you said, it is the way this report just kind of sounds the alarm about how China is quickly improving its capability to invade Taiwan. So one part of the report says, quote, "The PLA continues to prepare for contingencies in the Taiwan Strait to deter and, if necessary, compel Taiwan to abandon moves toward independence. The PLA also is likely preparing for a contingency to unify Taiwan with the mainland by force." End quote. And this, the report spends quite a lot of time detailing the way China's Marine Corps has expanded from 2 brigades up to 6 over the last few years, and also how the Army, although the Army is downsizing in terms of numbers, its focus has been more and more on its invasion capacity. Almost, and it's hard to think of how that would be applied anywhere besides Taiwan. So this report shows that China would prefer to unify Taiwan without using force, but that it reiterates that China is willing to use force and is increasingly capable of doing so.
How capable is Taiwan militarily of defending itself?
Yeah, Chinese defense spending is notoriously not very transparent. But even if you go by the published numbers that they put out, China spends more than 14 times more on military matters than Taiwan does. And this new report points out that Taiwan has kind of historically maintained some advantages over China, such as technological superiority, and also just kind of the inherent geographical advantage of defending an island. But suddenly, though, the report says, quote, "China's multi-decade military modernization effort has eroded or negated many of these Taiwanese advantages." So those areas where Taiwan used to kind of have a leg up on China are not really there anymore, at least not to the degree that they long have been. And then the U.S. is also a huge part of the equation here, because military equipment and security promises from America have been the main reason why Taiwan has not been invaded by China over the last few decades. But now both China and Taiwan see that the U.S. is becoming more insular, it's becoming deeply divided, it's tired of fighting wars all over the world.
Essentially what we were talking about with respect to Japan in the first half.
Exactly, yes. They can both see this, and in many ways you could liken Taiwan to Japan in terms of its relationship with the United States. Mm-hmm. Both of them have, you know, since the end of World War II, they've been staunch allies of the U.S., although in the case of Taiwan, it's unofficial. But it's still been a remarkably strong relationship. But now, though, all that's shifting, and these countries see that America's will to use its power is basically broken. So many of those advantages that Taiwan has long had are now gone or rapidly eroding.
And looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, why is this of interest?
Well, this is of interest really for the same reasons that we spoke about in the first half, about the Kings of the East power bloc. Back in 1998, when President Bill Clinton became the first American president to publicly kind of oppose Taiwanese independence, at that time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said that that meant it was only a matter of time before Taiwan would be conquered by China. He wrote an article called Taiwan Betrayal, and I'll just read a short quote from that. But it says, quote, "How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? It is going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America," end quote. And then he explains that his view on that dynamic is based on Bible prophecy. There's a prophecy that he discusses there in Leviticus 26 that just shows that America would eventually become so mired in sin, such as those sins that Andrew spoke about in the first half, that its will to use its power would be broken. And at the same time, you have these prophecies about the kings of the East coming together. And so countries like Taiwan and China and Japan, would these two trends end up shifting them away from the U.S. axis and toward the Russo-Chinese kind of counter axis there. So it's really fulfilling both of those trends at once.
Yeah. Well, we will put a link to that Taiwan Betrayal article in the show notes. Anything else that you would point people to, Jeremiah?
I had an article last year that takes a look at some of the history between Taiwan and China, and it also just discusses a lot of Mr. Fleury's Taiwan Betrayal article and the prophecies that's built on. It's called Will Emperor Xi Jinping Use His Vast Power to Seize Taiwan? And then also Russia and China in Prophecy, I think, is a great place to go if you want to see not just the short-term view of these kinds of prophetic events, but the long-term view and how this was all prophesied in scriptures thousands of years ago and how it's ultimately tied to very, very good news about the return of Jesus Christ.
All right, very good. Thanks for that. A little publicized speech by a little-known official in Iraq provided more evidence of Iran's intent to go on the offensive against Israel. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this speech was given on May 9th by Sheikh Ahram al-Kabi. He's one of the Shiite militias that Iran holds sway over in Iraq. And basically, in that speech, he had a lot of the rhetoric that we've heard a lot of recently about the hatred towards Israel, the desire to attack Israel, and things like that, calling Israel takfiri or they say that Israel is supporting the Islamic State and other anti-Shiite fighters. And anyhow, what's interesting about this is this man, while he's saying this, actually has, there's evidence to believe that he actually has control over a number of ballistic missiles that belong to Iran. There have been a number of reports that have come out of late that Iran is sending short-range ballistic missiles into Iraq, giving them to its proxies there and sending them towards the western area of Iraq, Anbar province and such, and the border of Syria, so that they can be used at some point in a war against Israel. There was a paper that came out from Reuters, I guess it was about 4 months, describing the initial stages of this. And then just this week, the Washington Institute of Near East Policy, they wrote about it, giving greater detail, talking about the type of missiles that have been given to such proxies as this Hezbollah group, a different Hezbollah from the Lebanese Hezbollah, and a couple of others And so this is presenting Israel with a danger that it hasn't seen, because normally we talk about the missile threat that Israel faces from Iranian proxies that are close by that share a border with Israel, being Lebanon or Hamas in the Gaza Strip, or even from Syria, and Israel does attack those. But now you have the Iranians that are giving weapons to Iraqi militias that operate inside Iraq, and they can reach Tel Aviv. The Zulfikar missile that has been deployed there, they're extremely accurate. They can fly over 650 kilometers, I believe it is. And so it puts Tel Aviv and the other major population centers of Israel within reach of, if you read this man's quotes, and he doesn't seem like a stable individual. And so it's a non-state actor, yes, that answers to Iran, but sometimes these proxies go rogue, and they have missiles that can severely hurt the state of Israel.
So put this in the context of what we were talking about in the first half with all of these levers that Iran has at its disposal that could create some real problems.
Yeah, well, in speaking about Iran's military capabilities, its missiles is what it has. I mean, it doesn't have a good air force. Sanctions have been on the regime for so long that it hasn't been able to develop any superior technology in that regard, apart from missile production and increasing the accuracy of their missiles and how far they can travel, and then also copying U.S. Technologies to create drones that can strike, like we saw the Houthis were using a highly capable drone that flew hundreds of kilometers and destroyed a very specific target. It has this ability. Iran doesn't intend to invade other countries with its normal military. Maybe they'll try to do that eventually, but their use of proxy forces across the Middle East is what makes them a danger, because they can unleash thousands of missiles on its enemies or strategic targets, on warships, on commercial shipping, on pipelines, that can throw the whole Middle East and the world into an absolute chaotic place, that can put a hold on the oil and also can put Israel into great threat. And so this is what we're seeing. So many levers that Iran has. Yes, they wouldn't win in an outright war against the United States, but there's so much they can do detrimental to U.S. and its allies in the region short of that. And Bible prophecy says they are going to unleash that at some point. We have written an article up. I think this was a couple of months ago. I wrote an article about how Iran has conquered Iraq, and how they, after they conquer Iraq, their next goal is Jerusalem. That's what they have said ever since the Iraqi-Iran war. They say the road to Jerusalem goes through Iraq, and so now they're using Iraqi territory to pursue that ambition of targeting Israel. It's just another front that Israel has to be concerned about in its fight against Iran. That article, if anybody wants to read it, it's entitled Iraq is Conquered Onto Jerusalem.
All right, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. The Pope is shaking up the way the Catholic Church is governed. To learn why this is significant, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Important story from the Catholic Church, where it's really right in line with exactly what we've been saying to watch for in the Catholic Church. So since 2013, Pope Francis has been overhauling the way the Catholic Church works. And so recently, there's been news coming out of a complete reorganization of the way the church works. This will be published on, or it looks like it will be published sometime around June 29th, all the details. But the big important thing is that the department that tries to reach out to other groups and bring them into the Catholic Church is going to be given absolute top priority. So at the moment, there are two big departments that deal with this. There's the Congregation for Evangelization of Peoples, and that coordinates Catholic missionary activities. It deals mostly with third world countries. And then you have the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of New Evangelization, and that focuses mostly on kind of reversing this trend towards secularism within Europe and the West and first world countries. These two departments are going to merge, and it's going to become what's called a super dicastery, and it's basically going to be the most important of all the Vatican departments. It will supersede even the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is responsible for defending Catholic doctrines. So you're having the Catholic Church really and dramatically putting, reaching out to other people and other Christians that aren't, or reaching out to Christians that aren't Catholics, top priority. And that's exactly what we've been saying to watch for in the Catholic Church. You can go back and look at what Herbert W. Armstrong was writing decades ago. And he was saying, well, the Catholic Church is going to try and do more to bring in other groups. They're going to bring in all their protesting daughters back to the Catholic Church. And they've already made some huge steps towards that. You know, you had the 500-year anniversary of the Protestant Lutheran Reformation just a year or two ago, or the Protestant Reformation. And they had these big meetings and came a long way towards unity with the Lutheran Church. You've got the situation now where a significant chunk, and it might even be most, Catholic priests in the UK are ex-Anglicans that have come in to the Catholic Church through this process that Pope Benedict set up. And so it's been unfolding exactly the way Herbert W. Armstrong said it would, and this is just another step in that remarkable trend where the Catholic Church is reaching out and trying to bring these other churches in. And he made those forecasts based on prophecies like Isaiah 47 that describes a woman, a church and biblical symbol, a daughter of Babylon, who says, I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. You know, the children that came out of that church, she brings them right back in. Revelation 17 describes this same prophecy as well. And we have a chapter in our Heroes Right booklet called Returning to the Fold that goes through exactly what Mr. Armstrong said was going to happen. And he was writing this way before this trend got started and showing you, you know, what the Bible says, and then showing you how that has just really dramatically been fulfilled in the decades since he said that, going all the way up to this latest news announcement.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. We'll put links to those that article in the show notes, actually that chapter from the He Was Right booklet about Herbert W. Armstrong prophesying this. We also have an article up there by Andrew Miller called Pope Revamps Vatican to Gain Converts. You can find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com, and we'll put links to both of those in the show notes. Again, thanks, Richard. South Africa is experiencing major rolling power outages. To learn why and why this is significant, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, the nation of South Africa held municipal elections earlier this month, but one of the big takeaways isn't necessarily which party won. They stayed more or less the same share in the legislature, but one of the big election issues is like which party can keep the power on, which is amazing for a country that has was so prosperous at one time, that now you're getting like a whole swath of the country where you have like 12-hour blackouts that can just come at any time. You've got middle class, even wealthy families that are heating reading by candlelight at night and heating their food and their water and with bonfires. Some of them can get some have generators that they can use, but I mean, of course, the gasoline costs money and there's huge waiting lines to get these generators. The traffic lights don't work during these blackouts. I mean, the traffic's just crazy. Even factories and businesses, if you have a job at a manufacturing plant, you may not have work on any given day when the power is just out. Mm. And the reason for this is that the 95% of South Africa's electricity is generated by one state-owned company, Eskom. It's only generating a fraction of the power the country needs. And so in order to be fair to everyone, instead of just giving power to some and none to others, they're doing what they call load shedding, where they, instead of having one area of the country that just doesn't have power, all areas of the country are sharing the power outages, where you just cut power to this place for 12 hours and give it to here, and then you cut power from this place from 12 hours and give it to there. And it is really a function of the way the companies run, particularly the socialist aspects the countries run. It's very similar to the power outages you have in Venezuela, where when Venezuela took over, they nationalized all the electric capacity into this one power company that put this all their eggs in this one factory that relied on this one dam. And then there was a drought and the dam didn't work, and you had massive power shortages. In South Africa, it's not quite as simple. It is still one power company. It's been state-owned for decades, but after the African National Congress took power in 1994, they put even more power to this one company, started using like affirmative action programs to give electric jobs to especially like the blacks in South Africa, whether they were qualified for them or not. You had, as you do in most big government socialist organizations, a lot of cronyism where you're giving cushy jobs to your friends who may or may not be corrupt. And so now you've got a situation where they lost $9.6 billion, still can't find out where it went. That's obviously some sort of embezzlement or corruption charge. You have many unqualified engineers who are given the job just based on their race. It's like a third of all the ESCOM plants are inoperable right now.
Wow.
Which explains it, because if those third were operating, you wouldn't actually need the load shedding. You'd have enough power to just generate the nation. So it's definitely something. Just 95% of electricity comes from one company. It's very poorly managed because the government's running it in a very corrupt and inefficient way. And so we have an article we can put in the show notes. This is actually from last month when the problem was still going on. Brad McDonald had written, "Is South Africa the next Venezuela?" But it specifically highlights a comment our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, made when the African National Congress took power in 1994 about South Africa being the first of the Anglo-Saxon nations to give up its birthright. One of the literature we offer on this program a lot is the United States and Britain and Prophecy, showing that God gave these blessings to the nations of Israel, the European settlers of South Africa in particular, being descended from those nations, having received some of those birthright blessings, and it being the first of those nations to give that up, and to are now, instead of having the birthright blessings like America and Britain, it's operating more like Zimbabwe or Venezuela. And it's something this program pointed out a lot. It's almost kind of like a canary in the coal mine scenario of this is being the first nation, almost like a preview into what the other Anglo-Saxon nations, Canada, Britain, and the United States will be facing at some point in the future, near future.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Orison Swett Marden. "It is just the little touches after the average man would quit that make the master's fame." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.